causing a riot. It's causing a riot.
Lionel, are you lousy cop? Don't you touch that kid.
Riot on Sunset Strip stars Alto Ray, Mincy Farmer, Michael Evans, Larry Mock, Tim Rooney in The Happening that blazed headlines across the nation.
Well, I tried every fun.
Teenagers, wild, beat, protesting, with no direction, no goal, fighting only for the right to be heard. Have you ever been to a blanket party?
Grass. Grass smokers.
Their story is it shouldn't be unlawful.
Come on, get with it. Let's go to a freakout. You know what acid can do to an inexperienced young girl?
I don't know what happened.
Five boys have been here.
The most shocking film of our generation.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Do the appropriate music. No, no, no. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And thank you very much, Michael H. Price, author of, most recently, The Forgotten Horrors Reader, which I am reading right now and loving every minute of it. It's great. You've got some stuff from Human Monsters. You've got some stuff that Christina, your wife, wrote. You've got some stuff that you wrote. You've plugged some stuff in. I'm just having a wonderful time with it. I heartily recommend that book.
We wind up with more stuff than we know what to do with.
We do. Stuff is a good euphemistic term to use there.
Yep.
Well, speaking of stuff, we've got Ride on Sunset Strip to talk about tonight. Not exactly a horror film, but boy, there's some creepiness in it. And a little bit of background on it. This was shot right after the Sunset Strip riots of 1966, of November 1966.
Right.
The same riots that inspired Stephen Stills to write For What It's Worth for Buffalo Springfield.
Yep.
And it revolved around a place called Pandora's Box, which was a teen nightclub. My friend Jim Carstein, the rock and roll drummer, told me just recently he and Carl Radel, the bassist, and Leon Russell had a residency there in the early 60s. They were the house band there for about a year at Pandora's Box. And the thing that people may not know about Pandora's Box, given its historical significance, is that it was basically on a traffic island. It was a tiny little place on a traffic island in Hollywood.
Naturally.
And Carstein said, you know, the kids would line up, and they'd be lined up, and then it would stop at the street, and then way down across this huge intersection, they'd be clear lined up, clear back to, well, he said back to Rocky and Bullwinkle, which meant back to the Jay Ward offices. And so they had a riot. Essentially, it was about curfews, which I believe, Michael, at that time was 10 p.m. And
that's
also
right.
About, was that right? And also about loitering. And
yeah, there was pretty much a zero tolerance policy.
Right, right. And within 6 months of the riot, which really wasn't all that much of a riot, it was precipitated by forces outside of the Kids Control, which essentially was a traffic jam with some Marines, and everything got all crazy. But within, I'm told, or I have read that within 6 weeks, Jungle Sam Katzman had that film shot, edited, and out on the streets.
Oh, he didn't waste time.
No,
Katzman
he did not.
Didn't waste time. And, of course, Sam Katzman alone is a reason to include a film in a Forgotten Horrors-type discussion. I mean,
yeah, it's a good
guy,
point.
The guy practically invented the low-budget talking horror picture.
He practically did. That's right, back in the early 40s with Monogram, right?
And even earlier than that, at ancestors of Monogram, like Puritan Pictures.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, he, in fact, I'm glad we're talking about that, because, in fact, his director for Right on Sunset Strip, Arthur Dreyfuss, went back with him to the 30s.
Right, and Dreyfuss was, you know, I mean, how old do you have to be before you're too old to develop a youth exploitation movie?
Right.
Well,
yeah, those guys are both, weren't they both in their 60s when they shot that picture?
Right, and they were both born in the first decade of the century.
Right.
And
right.
And lived on into fairly more recent times. But the real linchpin there was that both Sam Katzman and Arthur Dreyfuss had worked for PRC Pictures.
Right. Right. And Monogram, of course.
And, of course, Monogram. Uh-huh. And the blanket identity being Katzman's production company, Clover
yes.
Pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And, boy, oh, boy, of course, you have, so many of those things are almost interchangeable.
They are.
There's a stylistic distinction between Monogram and PRC, but otherwise they made pretty much, I mean, you could easily lump those together in terms of a corporate identity and output.
You could. I've always seen PRC as a little bit more adventurous, perhaps, but maybe that's just me romanticizing it. You know, I don't know.
And probably Monogram as being a little more clinical and
yes.
creepy.
Yes, I would say that's right. Well, mentioning Katzman, and by the way, one of the most just creepy turns in this picture is by the woman who plays Mimsy Farmer's mother, the drunk, Hortense Petra. Yeah. And Hortense Petra is actually Mrs. Sam Katzman. She played in a lot of his pictures. Little roles in a lot of his pictures. Well, my friend, he's passed. He's been gone for some years now. Darcy O'Brien, who is the son of George O'Brien, the cowboy star in Marguerite Churchill, grew up in Hollywood. And he told me, when I was talking to him about the movies, he and Sam Katzman's, I don't know how many children Sam Katzman had, but he, one of his sons and Darcy were the same age, growing up mm-hmm. in Hollywood. And he's told me two things that stuck with me. He said, when you went over to the Katzman's house to eat, everybody yelled at high volume. Everybody at the table yelled. I mean, it was nothing negative. They just like the loud family on Saturday Night Live. They were just loud. And the
old school Yiddish family.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the other thing was he had on his pool house, he had giant, at least life size, paintings. The pool house was painted with characters mm-hmm. from Sam Katzman films. So, of course, you had Batman and Robin, you had Superman, you had Jungle Jim. several others, and he said it was just this pantheon of these people. So, you know, sometimes we think, well, these guys were just doing this, you know, just knocking these out and didn't care anything about it. Well, obviously, Sam Katzman had a certain amount of pride in the films that he'd done.
Oh yeah, and he really fancied himself to be making art of a sort.
Yes.
He didn't consider his people hacks. I've got a quote in the files from Sam talking about the greatness of William Bodine, the director he often worked with.
One shot.
And Bodine had been a great silent film director.
Right.
And remained a very dependable director, but art is in the eye of the beholder.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Sam really wanted to believe in the quality of his films. As he said, basically his attitude was, well, if they weren't any good, they wouldn't be making money.
That's right. That's right. Of course, he was not beyond exploiting a trend, as he did with Ride on Sunset Strip. And to me, and see if it hits you this way, let me give a quick synopsis of the picture. It's pretty easy to synopsize. I mean, there's a bunch of kids on Sunset Strip, and the police are hassling them. And it's almost, it's kind of quaint, almost. They're hassling them because they all look, they've all got their cardigans on, and, you know, a few of them have long hair, but they're getting hassled for, you know, for loitering and for breaking curfew. One of them's probably the best thing Tim Rooney ever did, I think. And I know that you probably saw where they were, to me, They were sort of doing in jokes about Mickey Rooney when they talk about Shiler Hayden's dad's being, oh, you know, he's a star. He was married six times. And then when Tim shows up in that jalopy, it seems to me to that Sam Katzman is at least channeling Andy Hardy and the Mickey Rooney, the Mickey Rooney pictures, the Andy Hardy pictures. It looks like, I mean, it just looks like they're cut from the same cloth. But at any rate, so they're doing all this. We see some great rock and roll at the very first. We'll talk about that in a little bit. And Mimsy Farmer is kind of a lost soul in this. And I've read things that indicate her performance in this was what kind of paved the way for her to later on go to Italy and do the Argento thing, you know, Four Flies on Grey Velvet, as was known here, and all of those things, and become a star in Italy. But she does a star turn. I mean, this is her picture, definitely. And then after they drop, they go someplace, and it's all this kind of, oh, these kids kind of getting into trouble, and then they drop acid, and it gets really creepy and ugly. And it seems to me to be almost two pictures in that way. Do you have any comment on that?
Very formal. It comes right at the turning point when the wholesome teenage rock and roll movie was becoming the darker hippies and bikers picture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably it took on kind of a dual personality as a consequence. It's got that really nice element of film noir underscoring it, I think mainly due to the presence of Aldo Ray.
Yes. Who was in a little bit of a transition himself, wasn't he, going from leading man to low-budget star,
and he had made, among many other outstanding assignments, Aldo Ray had, in recent times, about 10 years earlier, starred in one of the best of the post-World War II films noir called Nightfall.
Yes, mm-hmm.
And so you get that, and he's not a typical looking. He doesn't look like a movie cop. That qualifies him even more to play a movie cop.
Right.
He looks like a guy. He looks like the kind of good guy to whom bad things often happen.
And they do in this.
And they do.
And he is the police chief. We should say the police chief who's tasked with keeping Sunset Strip orderly.
Yeah.
And he also happens to be Mimsy Farmer's character's father.
Right. Piece of work. Piece of work. I don't know that any. We've been talking a lot about the element of rock and roll in films of the period, specifically the early '60s. But
yes.
Of course, 1966 was a transitional year for that musical idiom as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot think of, you know, with the possible exception of. Maybe James Brown in Ski Party. I can't think of a better use of music and of rock and roll music in a movie of this general nature.
It's wonderful, and you know I'm a huge Stan Dales fan, so I knew the Stan Dales were going to be good, and then I love Ride on Sunset Strip. The song, I think it's a terrific tune, and I also think it's great to be able to see the Chocolate Watch Band, which I had not seen on film before, although. You know, they did show up in a few things, but my Lord, they're you know, the lead singer, who I understand went off and became an astronomy professor later on, were in Hollywood Rock, Marshall Crenshaw. It's a pretty good book about rock and roll movies, and Marshall Crenshaw, the artist, wrote it, and the musical artist wrote it, and he says that Don't Need Your Lovin' that they play in the film is a canny rewrite of Milk Cow Blues. And I hadn't really thought of that before. Of course, you and me both being Western swing people, you think of that. Yeah, that's probably right, you know. But Milk Cow Blues also, of course, is a canny rewrite of other things too, you know. you get into Brain Cloudy Blues, then you get into all of that sort of stuff. But the one that I was trying to run down, because I own the soundtrack album, which is on Tower Records, as so many of those AIP ones were, and I knew there was another band in there, and I played that soundtrack album, and I could not find the band. Well, that's because the other band that you see in that, the early part, you really don't see the bands in the later part of the picture because it's all concentrating on the awfulness that happens to Mimsy Farmer after she's dosed. But the third band in that is the Enemies.
The Enemies, yes.
E-N-E-M-Y-S.
Right.
And that is Corey Wells' band, later on from Three Dog Night.
Yep.
And
a lot of history.
Yeah, there's a lot of history there. And even if you go on the internet, you can find the Enemies playing on an episode of Beverly Hillbillies. Like I said, I do way too much research for this, but they're playing on Beverly Hillbillies when Jethro and Miss Hathaway go to a teen club. And Miss Hathaway gets funky, does the funky chicken or something while the band's playing. But they did a song, the Enemies do that song, the song called Jolene, which is really one of those big Boss Man, you know, kind of knockoffs, that progression and everything. But that's the Enemies. That's the third band that you're seeing there. And I think they were, as nearly as I can tell, they were contracted to MGM at that time.
That would make sense, yes.
Now, see, they had a lot of these people had just done, I believe they'd just done Hot Rods to Hell. Am I right there?
That would be very close in time, yes.
Laurie Mock was in that. Laurie Mock is the good girl at Hot Rods to Hell, where Mimsy Farmer is the hellion. And then it kind of gets a little bit of the switcheroo going in right on Sunset Strip. But if I'm not mistaken, I believe that Arthur Dreyfuss directed Hot Rods to Hell, too. Am I right there? I cannot remember.
My thinking is, yes, I believe he did. I've got a note here. This was, actually, it was John Brom.
John Brom, okay.
Another slumming major league director.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Dreyfuss had been slumming a lot longer than Brom.
Well, that's exactly.
But Katzman provided a safety net. I mentioned one of his production companies, Clover Production. Mm-hmm. Well, the Clover Production unit was mainly active at Monogram Pictures in the 40s, but of course the production company on Hot Rods to Hell and the present film Ride on Sunset Strip and even the Fastest Guitar Alive, among quite a few others, that Katzman company, rather than Clover Productions, was now Four Leaf Productions.
Right.
So he knew better than to turn loose of a good thing. Always struck me funny, my uncle who knew Katzman.
Now, this is your Grady, your Uncle Grady, right?
My Uncle Grady Wilson, who ran movie theaters in Texas and was pals with Katzman and many of the other low-budget impresarios, he said Katzman always reminded him of a Jewish leprechaun. And, of course, Clover Productions, Four Leaf,
sure.
it's natural.
Might as well have been called Pot O' Gold.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Well, so did you ever get to meet Sam Katzman?
On a few occasions in the early 60s, and he was delightful.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I had the double advantage of working in the essentially Jewish mercantile industry and shops down the street from my uncle's theaters, and Sam was pals with a lot of those guys.
Right.
From World War II period.
Mm-hmm.
And he would come to Texas to see how his pitches was doing, and he'd drop in on my uncle's theaters, and he'd drop in to visit the Solniks and the Altmans and the Cohens and all that down the street at the women's clothiers, and sometimes I'd be working at one of the theaters, sometimes I'd be playing clerk at one of the shoe stores, and what a great guy! He's the first guy to put Bela Lugosi in true context for me.
How can you explain that a little bit?
What kind of a guy Lugosi was?
And what kind of a guy was he?
He said he was a mensch.
Mm-hmm.
Great sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
Said he knew he was slumming, but you just give him a compliment and a $5 cigar, and he's happy. And I mean, he was aware of his own place in that scheme,
of course,
because he knew Bela Lugosi was too good for Sam Katzman's pictures, but timing is everything.
Right. Right.
And it's, I think it's quite well that Lugosi got to make those, 9 pictures at Monogram.
Was it that many? I guess it was, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They're 9 pictures. If you count the spoofs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how many at PRC? I know Devil Bat. What else they do at PRC?
I think that was confined to Devil Bat.
It may have been, yeah. Which I've always loved that picture, but yeah.
That's a beautiful picture, and of course Lugosi. The 6 degrees of separation between rock and roll movies and Mad Doctor pictures, well, that degree of separation is probably Sam Katzman.
Well, I never thought about that, yeah.
He didn't... I don't think Sam chased trends. I think he was there when they happened and knew enough to capitalize on them before the excitement faded.
Right. Well, he sure did on this one, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He had a handle on things. And of course, he had savvy.
Yes.
He was a nice guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and that's ultimately the most important part.
Of course it is, yeah. And, yeah, I've been thinking a lot about it. This sounds a little random, but I've been thinking a lot about something that the old Bob Wills sidemen always used to tell me. And they'd say, you know, mm-hmm. Bob had a chance. Of course, I'm talking about Bob Wills, the Texas Playboys, the Western Swing Band. And if Bob ever had a chance of hiring a great musician who was not a very good guy or a great guy who was not a very good musician, he'd always hire the great guy because there were so many intangibles there, I guess. And I'm not saying that Sam Katzman couldn't make pictures. He the tone of this picture is very weird to me because it goes from sort of childish teenage exuberance to gang rape, you know, and it's just a hard jump to make. And especially with the rock and roll in the early part of the picture, which is so good. I mean, that holds the sense of the teenage scene in that, mm-hmm. as you have pointed out, that transition period, 1965-1966, is spot on, even with the stupid little, not stupid, but even with the choice to do narration right at the very beginning of it, make it sound a little bit like a documentary.
That's a hangover from Monogram.
Is it?
Allied Artists in particular, mm-hmm. The Allied Artists version of Monogram. The film noir approach, the idea that you're hearing a voice of authority describe the situation to you.
Right.
But Sam knew enough to get out of the way, and he had the good sense to hire the genuine article when it came to his music.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he did. I mean, the Standells, that's terrific just watching them when that film opens up. With old Dick Dodd starting to sing, going out to the strip tonight. I'm not on a stay-home trip tonight from those drums. I mean, that's just it. That just, to
yep.
me, that just pulls you right into the picture. Again, I find it disconcerting, I guess, the way the turn that the picture takes. And it stops being about the music and starts being a little bit seamier. But, you know, I will say that we're talking about guys who are pretty deep in their 60s making this picture. I don't know how old the scriptwriter was, but he does give everybody a kind of a fair shake.
Does indeed. And, of course, you know, American International had pretty well paved the way for that sort of attitude in their films as early as, well, let's see, Riot on Sunset Strip appeared during 66, 67.
Uh-huh, early 67, yeah.
AIP had established that tone as early as, well, probably, what's the first thug picture to come out of AIP?
Is it Crybaby
Killer?
Yeah.
Crybaby Killer.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly Terror from Year
4000.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, the apocalyptic picture. panic in year zero. Yeah. I was inflating it to year 5,000.
Okay.
A panic in year zero,
<All right. laughs>
which has precisely that unfortunate element at the pivotal episode of rape.
Yes.
And basically was the picture that connected Frankie Avalon with AIP and the Beach movies to come.
Well, that's true. And I think and now 66 was also Wild Angels, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there you've got that
going
as well.
There are precedents, and Katzman, as much as he was a pioneer, I think he also knew what was making money and how he could add to it without cheapening the product.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, he did a good job there. A couple of things, just trivial things for people to watch for, and you probably caught it. There's a former Lone Ranger in the cast. With John Hart is one. I believe he's one of the policemen. I believe I spotted him as one of the policemen. I've seen him.
I believe
in the cast.
He's in the police force.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Go ahead.
Well, the number one guy that, because as Joey and Emily and I were watching this picture a couple of weeks ago,
mm-hmm.
the guy shows up that's supposed to be the cool dude, the one that's the son of the movie star that had six wives and everything. And you look at him, and he looks identifiable. I mean, he looks like somebody that you've seen before, but he's not. He's Schuyler Hayden.
Mm.
And Schuyler Hayden had spent, you know, a lot of his own money to make Rat Fink, as I understand it. And
right.
That was in 65. And then that, apparently, he parlayed that into this role as this really kind of evil figure, or maybe amoral, maybe is a better term, amoral figure,
mm-hmm,
in
mm-hmm.
Ride on Sunset Strip. And, you know, he's got a presence, Michael. He's really got a presence, and yet I think he did maybe a Burke's Law after that on TV, and that was it. He didn't do anything else. Died in a plane crash 11 years later in San Diego. And you look at Schuyler Hayden, and to me, he just commands the screen.
Mighty strong presence.
He is. And he looks, he's an archetypal looking, juvenile, whatever the late 60s version of juvenile delinquent was. You know, he's got it. He's got that look. He's got everything that us landlocked, or we landlocked people thought about, thought that Hollywood was like in the 60s. He's got that. He's almost got a kind of a Warren Beatty vibe or something going when he's in this picture.
Mm-hmm.
And then
didn't register much beyond that.
Nope, did not register much beyond that at all. Now we're not don't want to do a spoiler alert or anything, but we're going to be talking about Rat Fink, which was a lost film for a long time. I know all during Bill Boyce's life. He wanted to see it, but he didn't want to see it. Because he and James Landis were very good friends. James Landis, the director, did Egon and The Sadist and those. And he and James Landis were friends. And James Landis, and Bill was kind of this all-American guy who had played football in the Little Rose Bowl in the 50s. And done all of this stuff. And, of course, anybody who's seen him in Slime People, he's a male lead in Slime People. And he was a good friend of ours. We're getting ready. Joey is putting the Bill Boyce Money Actor documentary that we did will soon be available for sale.
Oh, yeah.
But Bill always said, James Landis came to me and he said, Bill, can you play a sissy? And Bill said, well, what do you mean? He says, can you play a sissy? And he said, he challenged me to play a sissy in this film. So, and I always said to Bill, I said, Bill, we're going to find this film because I want to see you play a sissy. He said, I don't really want to see it. He says, so that'll be an interesting thing. He may just have a fleeting cameo. I have no idea. But that was the film that Schuyler Hayden got a lot of press about. I mean, for a very low budget film, he got generally good reviews, especially for the kind of film it was. And listen, this star turn that he does even though he's kind of an evil guy or an amoral guy, the star turn that he does in Ride on Sunset Strip is very impressive. And yet he did nothing after that.
Too bad.
You know, that's one of those sad things, yeah. And then he died very young in an airplane crash. So there you have it. But now, would you say, would you recommend Ride on Sunset Strip? I'll just put you on the spot.
Oh, I wouldn't have agreed to talk about it if I wouldn't recommend it.
I guess
you know, life is too short to spend your time dissecting films you don't really want to see.
Well, with the exception of The Beds That Eat People.
Oh, well, I'd watch that again.
I'd watch it again, too. You hear Joey laughing in the background over there. That was Joey's choice. If you haven't heard that, we've got a podcast on it's just one bed. I said beds, the bed that, bed that eats people. With reservations, it's got some of the great rock
and roll. I'd rather watch that than the eats that bed people.
I think you're probably right on that.
So, it's like I wouldn't go beyond that. But of course, the objective is. I'm sure you, like me, probably had a period in your life where you said, "Well, I'm gonna watch every horror movie that exists."
Sure.
And even the ones that aren't horror but have Boris Karloff in them, mm-hmm. like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize at a certain point, it's like, boy, that's like total fairness in journalism. It's an unattainable ideal.
Exactly. It sounds like a good idea until you get down to it. That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
But I'm always delighted to rediscover something I had kind of let slip, like another James Landis film, The Sadist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's little pictures that you probably saw at an age when you were too young or too inexperienced to appreciate what they were saying. Johnny Guitar, which I saw at age what?
Mm-hmm.
Six.
Mm-hmm.
Too young to appreciate, but still a fascinating picture to go back to. And and not only to rediscover, but to just to discover outright, you know, how did we miss that?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I know when I was in a small town, Chelsea, Oklahoma, growing up, we had one theater, and the proprietor, Walter Willis Bell, got the cheapest movies imaginable. And it was very funny. My mother would not let me watch juvenile delinquent films, which is, of course, why I'm fascinated with them today, probably. But I could watch horror films, which was very interesting choice to me in terms of curfews and things. But I remember watching Last Woman on Earth as part of a double bill. So I would have been about 11. I think that came out in 1960. Would have been about 11, and I absolutely fell in love with Betsy Jones Moreland. I just thought she was just, and you know, so you get on those things, and you know, you think the little films, maybe it's our upbringing. The little films are the films that, you know, one of these days we ought to do a podcast on The Nasty Rabbit, as long as we're talking about James Landis. You know, I mean, that would be a great a crazy spy picture with supernatural overtones, I guess. I've never seen it. Have you seen it?
I've seen it, but not in many years.
Right.
Things, you know, I mean, sometimes, especially in our racket, we get too busy making stuff to worry about catching up with other people's work. And then you realize the imperative to appreciate and understand other people's work so that you can fold it into your own work.
Exactly.
You know, of course, this podcast doesn't really feel like work, but I suppose it qualifies.
Right. Well, that's true. Yeah, there's. I mean, we're not exactly out there roughing. You know, I mean, it's not that kind of work at all. But
you got to think fast, nonetheless, or you will fall off a high precipice.
That's exactly right. We've both fallen off a couple in the course of these podcasts, I think. But
yes.
But you're right. Yeah, and here's the thing. I think that I've thought about this a lot, and I know you have too, because you've made films. You know, I've made films. I was lucky enough to write a made-for-TV movie. You have done, you know, many, many things along those lines. We've worked both sides of the street. And I think, you know, we both have a disdain for snark. And I think that disdain comes from working both sides of the street.
I think it comes from understanding, yeah, exactly, from understanding. With the possible exception of Lloyd Kaufman, nobody ever really sets out to make a bad movie.
Right, right.
And to know that it's difficult to make even a picture that is lacking in many respects.
Sure. Well, you know, you look at, and I was talking to somebody the other day, and I said, you know, you watch even a bad film, and you see how many people it took to make this film, how many people that are really trying to do their best. And then you have the power to tear it down in 15 minutes. If nothing else, it's just like the distribution of labor is just off on that, you know. And that's why, again, I don't think because you can do something, you should do something. But, of course, we live in an age when anybody has access to a kind of mass medium.
And, it's like some landlubber buying him a pair of Speedos and thinking he's a competitive swimmer.
Exactly. That's that whole citizen journalist idea, and my thing has always been, you know, if you're so hot on citizen journalism, next time you get a toothache, go to a citizen dentist. You know, I mean, honestly. So anyway, that's enough railing on that. And you've got, tell me what you got out, because you've been protean here over the past few months.
I think both you and Joy will be aware of Deep in the Horrors of Texas.
We are both aware of it. I'm aware of having a nice story in it that I appreciate you putting in. my barbarian parody, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Which gave the book the crucial. You know, if you're gonna do a book about horror in Texas, you cannot ignore Robert E. Howard.
Right. Exactly.
And that story of yours, Barbarian Morning, touches base with Howard without actually being Howard, but rather calling attention to the creation, Conan in particular.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
It's like, well, we can't say the word Conan, but we can sure drop the suggestion.
That's right, and we sure did. Wasn't anything subtle about that, was there?
No. Subtlety is beneath our dignity.
Well, I've really enjoyed Deep in the Heart of Texas. It has so many things. It has some of those things that you did, I know, for heavy metal that are just wonderful, those stories. I mean, there's such a... Well, as in most of your anthologies, I mean, there's just such a wide variety of stuff. How can you not be entertained? I mean, it's just new thing.
Well, we're working on the sequel right now, and that's falling together very nicely.
Good, good. Well, tell me, you just now launched the Forgotten Horrors Reader. Can we mention it at the first of the show? Can you give me a little bit more about it?
That's actually a collection of... essays that have done double duty as book chapters and as newspaper columns, the main contents being a book that was originally called Human Monsters and has had, two editions under that title.
Right.
And finally I says, you know, we need to tie this in with the Forgotten Horrors identity, being as how it started out with both George Turner and me,
right.
and it's like, well, now let's figure out what else we got. And you get into the file cabinets and you realize, did I write that much stuff over like such a short period of time?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And a lot of it, including the chapters that my wife Christina composed for her film studies classes at North Texas State. Have never been published before.
Right.
And I went back to the original manuscripts, which, of course, I helped with as kind of a consultant, and I see these scribbled marginal notes from the professors saying, you ought to get this published, you ought to get this published.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, ought to never happens.
Right.
But here I said, you know, we put too much work into these to let them lie fallow for much longer.
Sure, yeah, and they're very entertaining pieces, too. I've been enjoying reading
it. It all clicks. It all clicks. I enjoyed especially working with her on the Griffith, D.W. Griffith piece. Of course, any excuse I can get to to say some words about Val Lewton.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I will
some,
take.
Yeah, some nice words about Val Lewton. And I think Leopard Man is really my favorite of all of his pictures, although I do have a real fondness for The Body Snatcher. But you'll mm-hmm. talk, there's kind of an extended discussion of Leopard Man in there that I really opened my eyes to some stuff, and it's very good. I would definitely recommend the book. And for baseball fans, we're going to be sailing in pretty quickly. This is we're doing this in August, and we're in baseball season, sailing pretty quickly at the World Series. And my book with the World Series hero Ralph Terry, the GOAT in 1960 when he gave up the home run to Bill Mazeroski, and the hero in 1962, the only man to win to be on the mound for the last pitch of two World Series Game 7s in baseball history. And that book is out there, and we're actually getting wonderful reviews on it. We got a great review from the Boston Globe, and we've gotten mentions New York Times and New York Daily News and just kind of all over the place. So I know that this is not a baseball podcast, but a lot of times there's baseball fans out there, and I would humbly suggest that you take a look at the book online, see if it might be something you like, or maybe your baseball-loving uncle might like.
Yeah.
So, you know, and we'll keep it up. I've just finished a novel that is now with my agent, a horror novel called The Cleansing, which I wrote with Robert A. Brown. And it's So we're strapped in on that and working right along. So we thank everybody for listening to the podcast. And again, we humbly suggest that if you'd like to support us, to take a look at what Michael H. Price and or John Woolley has out there for sale. Just it's one mouse click away. Hey, Michael, thank you. I enjoyed watching
Delighted.
This picture, and I actually think Joey, you enjoyed it, did you not?
I loved it. Yeah,
it's.
I
think it's a very interesting picture. It's worth your time, and especially for those who love '60s rock and roll music, the first half is just killer. You will not forget the Chocolate Watch Band at all. They're kind of the front man is kind of a cross between Joey Ramone and Mick Jagger. It's really interesting setup that they had, and there's not many chances to see those guys live. So, on behalf of our producer, Joey Hambrick, Michael H. Price, and myself, John Woolley, thank you for listening to the Forgotten Horse Podcast. We'll be back before you know it.
Strip tonight.